You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello. We're moving right through it because Evan is going to his daughter's daycare graduation, pre-K graduation. I don't even know what it is. He's got to go. I'm going to tell you
guys who's on the show today.
Today on the show, Hannah Goldfield. She's the food critic at The New Yorker. She writes the Tables for Two column. It comes out every week. She reviews a different restaurant in New York. We talked about that job, how you do it, how it changed in the pandemic, how you find different words to describe things that are crunchy. We talked about it all. It's a fascinating job. She was great to talk to. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I love the pace we're operating right now. I think we should adopt this as our pace going forward. We're brought to you in partnership with Vox Media. They help us make the show. Thanks to them.
And congratulations to Juno for graduating from 3K. And now here's Max with Hannah Goldfield.
You slowed it down at the end. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Thanks for doing the podcast.
Sure. I'm honored to be here.
I have so many questions about your job.
Okay.
There's all these things about being a food critic that I don't understand. I've talked to a couple of people over the years on the show who do the job, although I think you do it like slightly different than they do. But I, in doing some research before this, I learned that you have wanted to be a food critic for a long time. So I was wondering if we could start with your origin story, your food critic origin story.
Yes. I loved eating as a kid. It was just sort of an obsession for me from a very young age. And as I remember it, of course, some of this has to be apocryphal, but the story that I've always told myself. And
none of this is going to get fact-checked.
Okay, good. You can call my parents. I saw the movie My Best Friend's Wedding in the theater. I have fact-checked this. It came out in 1996, so I would have been 10 or turning 10. And in it, Julia Roberts plays a food critic and in like wildly unrealistic way where it's just like this total like farce of what any food critic has ever done. But that's her job. And the movie spends literally the first 5 minutes on it and it's never discussed again. But I was just like gobsmacked by the idea that this was a job. I knew that it was a real job. And after that, decided that was what I wanted to be when I grew up. And at the time, Ruth Rachel was the restaurant critic for The Times. And she just seemed like this really cool person. She was a writer. She was a woman. It just seemed like a job that I could do. And my dad was very encouraging of me reading her review every week. You know, he got The Times delivered. So every Wednesday, I would excitedly open up the paper and read the review. I remember him urging me to write restaurant reviews, which I declined to do
because that
was like work. No, I just read it until high school when I was an intern at like the, you know, weekly alternative newspaper. And they assigned me my first restaurant review. So my first restaurant review was published when I was 15 in the New Haven Advocate.
What did you review?
I reviewed a kosher deli. I don't remember why that was the assignment. I don't know that they even ran regular restaurant reviews, but somehow they sent me to this kosher deli.
There was just a burning desire
to
get the kosher deli
review? It seems really odd now because I don't even think it was new. Maybe they had just expanded or something. It was actually like owned by a classmate's parents.
It was owned by the publisher of the newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I am now like, was there some kind of backdoor dealings going on here? But it was like in a strip mall. And like looking back, it was very like, you know, Jonathan Gold or something, because it was not really a restaurant. It was like, it was very like culturally sort of different than what was going on in the more traditional restaurants in downtown New Haven that would have made more sense to write about, given the context of a restaurant review. But yeah, I went to this, I think it was called the Westville Kosher Meat Market. It's now closed. And they had like prepared foods that you could eat in, but mostly it was like a grocery, like a small specialty grocery store. And I remember eating in and also taking stuff home and writing about the whole experience. And then I didn't write another restaurant review until I had graduated college. I remember in college realizing that I wasn't the only person who wanted to be a food writer and deciding that I had to give up my dreams of being a food writer because I didn't want, the like barest hint of competition sent me like cowering into the corner. I was like, oh God, like, no, I got to do something else because it's too much of a thing to want to be a food writer. It was like, you know, it's like when you realize other people like your favorite band and suddenly it's ruined for you. I was like, I'm not the only like Jewish girl from, you know, Connecticut who thinks Ruth Reichel is amazing. This is horrible. I need a whole nother career plan. But then I became an intern at The New Yorker and then a fact checker at The New Yorker. And that led to writing Tables for Two. In my sort of first go around, I did it as one of several staff members who kind of took turns writing the column every week. So I found my way back to it and resumed my childhood fantasy, amazingly.
Once you had the job, you were willing to not compete for the
exactly.
job.
Exactly. I was like, okay, this has basically fallen into my lap, so I can no longer deny that it's what I still want to do.
Did you pan the kosher deli?
No, I gave it a rave review, and I was very like chatty. I actually reread it recently because my parents are moving, and my mom like has saved everything I've ever written. So I revisited it, and I wrote about my family. I was very cheerful and just kind of positive, which is, you know, suited the format, I think.
Did it feel like yourself?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it felt like my 15-year-old self. Like, I was like, I feel like as an adult, I'm much more conscious of trying not to be corny, and I don't always succeed. But like, as a 15-year-old, I was like so incredibly corny. You know, I made lots of like, because I was a total dorky 15-year-old, and I made lots of kind of dorky jokes. And I was very, I think I was writing for adults. Like, I felt like I'd been given this. I was this very young person amongst all these adults doing these adult things. So I was trying to like impress the adults in the way of like, you know, a kid at a cocktail party or something, trying to seem older than I was.
Well, I'm hoping that this is actually a decent bridge to your work now, but I feel like I have to ask, what was so off in My Best Friend's Wedding about her job as a restaurant
owner? Yeah. I mean, I guess I could be wrong. I've actually been thinking a lot about wanting to know more about kind of the history of the restaurant critic, but I don't think there was ever a time where it was functioning as it does in the movie, which is like she's sitting at a table with her, I guess he's her friend. And it's just like everyone knows that she's there and why she's there and who she is. Like, she's not in any way trying to fly under the radar. It seems like she booked the table through the restaurant and said, like, I'm coming in to review the restaurant. Actually, as I'm remembering the scene, I know that she did that because she's sitting there and all the chefs are looking through like a porthole window from the kitchen and watching as she lifts a fork and takes a bite. And then she very like clearly and loudly announces what she's going to say about the.
Really?
She's like, I can't remember exactly what she says, but she's like, I'm declaring it like elegant and but yet restrained or something. Like, it's like, and everyone's like, like there's this audible sigh of relief from everyone in the kitchen, and they're all just hanging on her every word. It's just like that would never. It's just a very cartoonish depiction.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing that it reminds me of is an actual cartoon, which is like, that's how the food critic in like Ratatouille works.
Exactly. Yeah. But even more so because it's, I think in Ratatouille, I think he's anonymous, or he at least like no one knows his real name, right? I feel like, and no one knows anything about him.
He like comes in and they're like,
it's him. Like, well, right. And like, and there are always restaurants, a certain kind of restaurant is always looking for a critic. So it's not. That's not the issue. It's the issue is that she is not even pretending, like, you know, it's not all just out and in the open.
Do you take steps to remain anonymous?
Sort of. I feel like the general consensus among restaurant critics today is kind of, in terms of how to comport yourself, is try not to let them know you're coming, but don't go to great pains to like literally disguise yourself, which is a thing that allegedly restaurant critics used to do. I mean, Ruth Rachel wrote a whole book about wearing disguises, which I have no reason not to believe her, but it like boggles the mind, the just effort to which she writes about going to disguise herself, wigs. It sounds like the scene in Mrs. Doubtfire where Robin Williams goes and has all of, he's fitted for different wigs and prosthetics. I mean, I believe that she did it. It just seems so crazy to me.
Just over the top? Like,
you
can't wrap your head around why someone would do that?
I mean, it seems fun. And I guess it's like, yeah, if you really want to be anonymous, that's what you have to do. But I guess I, at least in the context of today, I don't really understand why you would need to be that anonymous. I guess her argument was that she didn't want any special treatment and she wanted to really see what it was like to be someone who was perceived to just be like, you know, a nobody off the street. And she wrote one particularly like famous review where she had like a wildly different experience coming in as herself and coming in as like
Mrs. Doubtfire.
Basically, I actually think it was like a character, a sort of character modeled after like one of her mother's friends or something. And so she made herself look much older and a little like infirm and just kind of like a person who might not be treated with the same level of decorum as someone, you know, more important. And in that sense, so maybe it's sort of like she was conducting a sociological experiment. So, but that feels kind of like a different thing.
I mean, do people know who you are?
Yes. Some of them. You know, it's like, so I don't make reservations under my own name. I've never worn a disguise. I've definitely been recognized in ways that I've noticed, you know, like, I guess I feel like restaurants now, I don't know, I can't imagine that this wasn't true in the 80s, but I feel like restaurants take everything so seriously now, and restaurants that are good or that are trying to be like of a certain caliber are really trying to treat everyone with the same level of respect, and they're taking the food so seriously that I don't think there's a scenario where they're like slinging things lazily for most people, but then somebody important comes in and they suddenly like pull out the good ingredients that they were hiding in the back. You know, like,
so your feeling is basically like most places are doing as well as they can.
I think so. Or like maybe not most places, but the kinds of places that I would write about, like places that are buzzy and have, you know, chefs that are really respected and places that are just taking it all really seriously.
You think restaurants take themselves more seriously now than they did?
I don't know, but my guess is yes, because I think the restaurant industry has just changed so much that people care way more about restaurants. Just like, and I'm talking about like just this huge arc of like the rise of the celebrity chef, and then of course like the internet and the rise of everyone and their mother being a food critic by virtue of, you know, signing onto Yelp or any other website that does ratings. I do think that that restaurants just like that the whole industry just became more serious. Not that there weren't always restaurants and that it wasn't always a big business. It just feels like it's a different beast than it was.
Do you feel a responsibility in that ecosystem? Like, do you think of yourself as part of it or outside of it?
I think of myself as having a foot in it, I guess. I don't know. I guess I have never thought about that so explicitly. I mean, I feel in the last, God, how long has the pandemic been going on? 2 years? Longer?
Somewhere between 2 and 1,000
years.
Yeah,
yeah. I feel more of like a clear purpose since the pandemic and an obligation to encourage people to eat at restaurants, I think. So I think about this a lot. Like, I have not said anything remotely negative about a restaurant in the past 2 years.
I know that to be true.
Yeah.
Because I read them all, and I was just waiting for, like, the pan. And I just wanted to eat at every single
Right.
every single
well,
place
if you go back
meal.
A little farther, you can find some pans. But since, you know, March of 2020, I have not given a pan and I have not said anything unkind, I don't think. The most unkind I got was in what I thought was a very loving review of the Odeon. But it was also like, I felt like I could, because it's such an establishment and it's an institution, really, like I was a little kind of snarky, not about the food or about the way the business is run, but just sort of about like the vibe there. You know, I made some jokes about in restaurants like that, there's a, you know, there are like prime tables where people of note are automatically seated and then everyone else gets kind of like put in dark corners where no one else wants to sit. And I joked that dynamic had been transferred to the outdoor seating and got a little like fanciful in describing the worst tables and said that it was where, like, you know, line cooks took their smoke breaks and it was where they loaded vegetables in and out of the restaurant. And those things turned out not to be true. And the owner of the Odeon was just infuriated and wrote a letter to the local Tribeca paper, you know, arguing that I had like besmirched her good name and insisting that none of the chefs even smoked and they certainly wouldn't be smoking outside the door. Anyway, I did not think that was a negative review, but that was the meanest I've gotten in the past 2 years.
Did you issue a correction?
I think we did actually. I think we changed the wording on the online version slightly and I think attached a correction at the bottom of the online version. But I just feel like you can't kick someone when they're down, and right now still restaurants are down. So if I've gone to a place that I thought was really terrible, I've just not written about it.
You just bagged it.
Yeah, which I sort of like.
Even like a prominent place?
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking that I'm now at the point where I would maybe dip a toe back into being a little snarky. I went to a place last night, in fact, that I may or may not write about, so I won't say too much about it. But I was sort of like, I think this place could take a little bit of a burn.
Do you miss that part of the job?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the most fun things is to be a little arch. And I've definitely been just mostly earnest for years now. But I mean, like in a way that was refreshing, I think, because I think you can get tired of being too arch. And I feel like there was something kind of relaxing about feeling just clear about what I was doing, you know, like not like, I guess having to be less, being a critic is like, it's a weighty thing. You know, you have to defend your own thoughts in a way that you don't if you're just doing like straight reporting, which is more of what I was doing. Like I started during the pandemic to interview chefs and owners and made the column for a while really more of just like a little reported snapshot where I was telling someone's story. And I felt like, yeah, I just felt this sort of clear mandate to like stoke people into keeping these places going. And keeping the industry kind of alive.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
That thing you were just saying about having to defend your thoughts, do you just know what you think? when you take a bite of something? Like, do you have doubt, or is there no static in your taste?
I don't know. I guess the fact that I don't know means that I don't have doubt.
Yeah.
But I also think if you look closely, I mean, I hope this is what I'm going for, is that if you look closely at what I'm saying about the food, I'm not only, you know, declaring value judgments. I'm trying to describe it in such a like thorough and layered way that the reader hopefully is able to figure out if they would like it. You know, it's like if I describe the texture of something and the smell of something and how something tastes and what it looks like, I'm hoping that, like, you know, it'll come across if I like it or don't like it, but that also that I'm giving enough information so that you'll be able to tell, like, you know, well, that's not the kind of thing that I usually go for. Like, that sounds good or it doesn't sound good. I don't like things that, you know, remind me of what you said this dish reminds you of. You know, like, I think it's all about sort of giving space for someone to make their own judgments.
Is it challenging to come up with uniquely descriptive language?
Oh my
when
God,
you're doing this
yes.
every week?
Yes, yes. I was just discussing this last night with a friend, and like, that challenge it can be a lot of fun. And one thing that excites me about a certain kind of restaurant is that it kind of, some dishes lend themselves to surprising descriptions. And so I'll find that while I'm eating something, like, the poetry just kind of presents itself. I'll be like, oh, this reminds me of this, you know, experience. Or like, I'll have sort of like phrases that will just pop into my head. And that's when I'll take notes. And I like, that's always a very kind of light bulb over the head.
Right. So the food itself can inspire the language.
Yes. And that's like, and those are moments when I'm like, oh yeah, like, food really is an art form, because I feel like it's like, I'm just the messenger. Like, I mean, it feels like I'm not having to work that hard. Whereas other times I will just struggle for literally hours to figure out how to describe something that's like necessary to describe for the sake of the review, but isn't that interesting. And the thing I was talking about with a friend last night is how there are just only so many ways to say crunchy.
Yeah.
There's crunchy, there's crisp, there's crispy. You can say something crackles, and that's kind of it. Like, it's right. Really, really hard. And a lot of things are crunchy. It's like, it's a really specific sensation that needs to be described. But I've had moments where I'm like, I can't say crunchy again in the sentence. What am I going to do? How do I get this across? So yes, that is definitely one of the harder things about writing about food.
It seems really tough to me.
Yeah.
Like, it just like delicious. Like, how many ways can you say good?
Ideally, you don't want to say delicious or good, because again, that's the kind of just bland value judgment that you want to avoid. But
right.
Sometimes I do want to just be like, this is really good.
This is
like,
really good.
These are good. This is great. This is wonderful. Fantastic. Spectacular.
Well, I feel like that, I mean, not necessarily on like that level of superlative, but I feel like, you know, you've reviewed like takeout burger joints.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of like crispy and, you know, like much better adjectives that I can think of in this moment. But they're on some level, the column is basically like, it's really good.
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah,
this
totally.
Burger and fries.
Right.
Fucking delicious.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, sometimes there's only so much you can say, yeah, about a food that everyone has probably tried. There isn't anything I can really tell you about burger and fries that you didn't already know. Although, again, like, there are situations where, you know, the food itself lends itself to delving a little deeper. Like, I wrote about this fish and chips place that is now turned into like a full sit-down restaurant, and the process for making the chips, also known as French fries, was so involved and to me fascinating that I actually ended up like just writing a whole paragraph about how this guy made these French fries. And he had all of these reference points. He had gotten this one method from this person and another from another. Like, I guess it was not just the chips, it was the fish too. But that ended up being like a way to tell people something that they didn't know about French fries. But yes, and there are a lot of times when I feel like there is not that much to say about the food itself. And in those scenarios, you know, I think I often describe Tables for Two as being like a talk of the town story about a restaurant. And so I feel like I do have the freedom to kind of fall back on, you know, just trying to capture the scene, mm-hmm. capture a moment of time in New York City at a certain kind of place. So I'm always like thrilled when I overhear some other diner saying something really funny. It's gotten a little harder to do that, I think, during COVID, because people just aren't like in the world in the same way that they were. I feel like there isn't as much interaction between the guests in a restaurant.
Although I also feel like restaurants have, at least for me, taken on this totally different significance where, like, when I have had a great experience indoors at a restaurant, it is like in a full restaurant that's like loud.
Yeah.
It feels like time travel now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's definitely the case. But and maybe it's actually, it's that I'm just kind of rusty, but like I feel like, I think because, right, even for me, and I've never, there were stretches of time where I wasn't going to restaurants at all, but I was never not writing about them. I would write about takeout or all kinds of pop-ups and things, but I do feel like I'm still pretty new to indoor dining, and it's overstimulating. You know, it's like, just like, I remember the first time I went to a restaurant without a mask inside, which was, I guess, earlier this year, and it had been several months. I remember feeling like I had just come out of like hiding or something. It was
totally,
like, the lights were so bright and the music was so loud, and it was like just so overwhelming and socializing in that way. So I do think that's probably, like, I think I probably need to regain my ability to just kind of like calm down and observe.
Well, you know, like you can lose the rhythm of these things.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Easily. And I think restaurants lost their, I think ever, it's not just the diners. I think the restaurants lost the rhythm to some degree too. It's all like shifting and changing, but I do think we're moving back to something more like what it was.
Well, hopefully, you know, you'll get to a point where you're comfortable panning things again.
Yes.
But until then, as you think about the kinds of reviews that you're comfortable doing, man, I find it so interesting that you've walked away from places that you didn't feel like you could write about positively. How in touch with, like, the impact of these reviews are you? Like, are you thinking about what they could mean for the restaurants? Do you have a sense of what they mean for the restaurants? And then to what extent do you let that impact your work?
Yeah, I mean, my sense has been in the, you know, 4 years I've been doing this job, a little more than four, that I don't really have the ability to usually to make or break a restaurant in the way that I think the Times does. At least I think to some degree they have that ability. I think it's like, I think
do
it's
you a, wish that you did?
No, that feels like a lot of power to have. It feels like, I mean, I don't know. It's such a like delicate dance, because I'm sure there's something thrilling about, I mean, there's definitely something thrilling about giving someone a big boost, which I know that I've done. So I do feel like there are places that I have really helped in a way that feels great. Like there, it's actually really recently happened in a very explicit way, where I wrote about this Burmese restaurant that was in a subway station in Jackson Heights. And it was like a little kind of coffee shop where the idea was, you know, you'd get customers who were like rushing to the subway and they'd grab literally a coffee and like a bag of chips. And the owners started to serve some Burmese salads and soups and stuff. And they were getting like some attention, not much. I think I read about it, you know, on Eater and The Infatuation or something, and went to go check it out. And then I wrote a Tables for Two column about it. And I wasn't really aware of what happened after that. And then a couple of months ago, I got a message on Instagram from the daughter of this couple who is very involved in the restaurant. And she was like, please come to the opening party of our restaurant in the East Village. And they have like opened, like the whole story of my column was how, you know, this was like, they were struggling to find a place that they could afford to even have this coffee shop. And she told me, like, after your review, everything changed for us. And they, I guess, I'm sure they have investors of some kind, but they've recently opened like a proper restaurant, to which I have not yet been, but I'm looking forward to going to. So there's, yeah. So like, and yeah, I mean, how could I feel anything but great about that? They're like these really lovely people, who are making great food and came to New York for a better life, and like suddenly they have it, and to have had any part in that feels great.
But there's still like an embedded answer in that answer, which is it wasn't like you were waiting to see what happened.
No.
It's like you happened to find it out. So it's like a nice to have, but not the reason to do it.
Yeah, I think that that would be a dangerous way to think about it. Like, I think that would get wrapped up too much in my
Well, that's why I ask. I mean, it seems dangerous and also like enticing.
Yeah, no, totally. No, but
the question is kind of like, I mean, I understand that you're saying like the Times has a certain power that you don't feel you have, but there is some power to that role in particular, like just in the choice.
Definitely. But I would say that my choices are very selfish. they're selfish in like pursuit of my own goals, and my goals are not to like change, you know, a restaurateur's life. My goals are to make the column interesting and to keep it kind of dynamic and to make sure that I'm writing about a good mix of places from week to week in terms of price point and neighborhood and type of cuisine. So that's really what I'm thinking about. And it's such a kind of breakneck pace that I'm always just like on to the next one and feeling frantic about like, what am I going to write about this week? I've not mastered the art of like planning ahead. And I mean, I'm just trying to make sure there's something to write about every week.
How do you pick what to write about?
I read like what I sometimes refer to as like the trades, although they're not. I mean, I read Eater, I read Infatuation, I read Grub Street. I, in that way, just keep track of like what's opening, which, you know, they do as thorough a job as they can, I think. Although obviously there are just so many restaurants that are opening in New York all the time that no one is taking any notice of, except the people who are walking by. It's like astonishing. Like, I just went to a place recently that hasn't gotten any press coverage, even by these publications that are sort of keeping track. And I went because a friend had literally walked by and seen a grand opening sign and went and told me it was good. And so we all went back together. I read those sites, and then Instagram has become a huge resource for me. I follow like tons and tons of food people, like people who seem like they're obsessed with restaurants and are just constantly eating out. And that's kind of how I like a certain type of like influencer who seems to be keeping up on like the hot spots. And then I've found some kind of like people who I think 10 or 15 years ago would have had a food blog who are sort of like chow hounds. You know, they're like pounding the pavement in Queens or wherever, it's kind of outer boroughs, and chronicling what's happening there. And then I go try places. But this is like, there's a huge margin of error because you can only know that a place looks interesting, and then you can go there and discover that it's not interesting at all. And I would say, like, more often than not, the reason that I don't write about a place is not because it's bad, but because it's just not good enough. Mm-hmm. And I feel totally uninspired, and I have nothing to say about it.
Right. There's no light bulb moments.
Exactly. There's no story that emerges. And I can tell immediately, like, I'm just going to have nothing to say about this. And then I'm going to sit in front of my computer and, like, pull my hair out because I've got nothing to say.
It's, like, crunchy. It's very crunchy.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you think about making the column feel diverse and equitable? Like, you were saying, it's like different price points and different neighborhoods and different culinary traditions. But is there like an ethos to that? Is there a way that you track it and think about it?
It's a really good question that I don't have a great answer to. I mean, I wish there was a formula. It would make it all feel a lot easier. I kind of just go on instinct, and I think like I'll sort of have this feeling like, oh, I've been writing about too many of the same kinds of places. And I don't even know that I could tell you exactly what I mean by that. But, like, it is sort of based on a feeling. Like, well, I guess I could tell you what I mean by that. It's, like, too many places that are – that people like me would go to, you know, on a night after work. Like, a certain price point, a certain vibe, a certain neighborhood in Brooklyn or Manhattan. Like, those are, you know, it's hard not to get sort of drawn into the swan song of that. It's these, like, sort of buzzy, sexy places that are getting a lot of press because they have high-powered publicists who are making sure that everyone knows that they've opened. So, you know, lately I feel like I've been writing a little bit too much about places like that. And then I'll think, like, all right, I gotta just totally broaden my reach and drive to Queens one afternoon or see what's happening in Staten Island, which is really challenging. I think it's really interesting. I wonder what it was like to do this job when there was more local news, because I have tried so hard to figure out what new restaurants have opened on Staten Island. And there's just not, like, nobody seems to be writing about it. I think I have to go over there and, like, drive up and down the streets. Yeah, there was some coverage of the restaurants that Kim Kardashian and Pete Davidson, there was an article in the Times about how people are coming into any restaurant that they've been spotted in and asking, like, what they were like and what did they eat. And so there's, like, but that's the last time I've seen any restaurant coverage.
It's just
of Staten Island. Yeah,
Staten,
yeah.
Island. That's all that's available.
Yeah.
Is it a thing that you get feedback about?
Yes, occasionally. I mean, like, it's funny that I feel like the most feedback of that kind that I've ever gotten is from, like, elderly people on the Upper West Side who insist that I'm neglecting the Upper West Side. Like, and I feel like I've that's all been, like, third hand. Like, someone will be like, my uncle says you write too much about places downtown. Like, what's going on the Upper West Side? And the answer is not that much. Although, like, that's one of the things, like, every few months I'll be like, I gotta write something about the Upper West Side. And I'll you know, write to my two friends that live on the Upper West Side and ask them what's opened recently or what's exciting them. Other than that, I feel like a lot of the reading of the column is done in a kind of, it's a fantasy for people. So I think some people are using it as, like, a guide to New York, and I think some people are genuinely going to these restaurants. But I think, the New Yorker has a very wide readership geographically, and I do think people, even people outside of New York, read it.
Is it a lonely job?
No. I think it's actually a very social job in that I almost always bring people with me to eat. So it's like, it's the only way I socialize at this point. But I mean, I think writing is a lonely pursuit no matter how you cut it. So yes, the writing part feels very lonely, but I think it's different than basically any other writing in that you're, not only are you like I guess if you're a theater critic, you might bring a friend to a play, but you're presumably being polite and sitting silently watching the play together. Whereas when you take a friend to a restaurant review, like, you're talking as you would, you know, in any other circumstance where you're having dinner with someone. So in that sense, it's very social, although I do find myself sometimes realizing that I've like, invited the wrong kind of person to a restaurant review who doesn't want to, like, talk about the food at all. Like, I'm not so strict that it's like that we can't discuss other things, but you have to be interested in the food or else it's too distracting to me and I can't focus on paying attention in the way that I need to be paying attention. So
you, like, try people out?
I do try people out, yeah. Or, like, I think I learned the hard way that, like, I can't use a restaurant review as a way to see someone that I've been needing to see. That's an actually an especially good example. It's like if I'm needing to catch up with someone, or if, like, you know, my husband and I need to, like, we've been saying we'd have dinner with this other couple for like 6 months. It's like, that is not the right circumstances.
Because you're
like,
working.
Right. Exactly. I'm working. And it's a different kind of work if you're socializing with someone you don't know that well. It's like those two things are just so at odds. Like, you can't be learning all about someone's, you know, background and like what they do for work and also be like taking furtive notes about, you know, how the French fries were made or whatever. So it is like, it's not pure socializing, but I don't think it's lonely. Just the writing is lonely.
Yeah, I mean, this might just be like my version of the Julia Roberts thing, but when I think about your job, there are aspects of it that seem incredible and sort of like a fantasy. Like, my understanding from what you're talking about is basically that, like, assuming that your friends have some interest in food, you eat out all the time at new and exciting restaurants, get to bring your friends. You don't even have to write about the place, and someone else foots the bill. David Remnick pays for all this.
Yeah.
It's a pretty sweet gig.
Well, yeah. Well, the Newhouse family pays for it, I think. But yeah, no, it's an amazing job, and I don't take that for granted. It's totally fun a lot of the time, but it's also a job that stresses me out enormously at times. That definitely, I think at its most fun, it's more fun than any other job that I could imagine personally, but that doesn't mean that it's not. Like, when I'm, if I'm not writing about a restaurant, I'm really stressed out about it. Like, if I go to a place and I realize I can't write about it, I'm devastated because I'm just like scrambling, you know. I just like, it's like, even if I'm kind of on top of things, it's like I still have to file something that week. And so, like, even if I'm like working a few columns ahead, it still means that I'm suddenly gonna find myself probably backed into a corner where it's like, what am I going to write about this week? It's just like writing anything on a weekly basis is really hard. And I think it can seem simpler because it's usually things that come out weekly are short. And it sort of can seem like someone has just jotted something off because it's maybe only a few paragraphs. But I would argue that is really challenging. And it's like, it's hard to write short.
Hugely stressed out.
Yeah. Everyone should know that behind the scenes, I'm enormously stressed out. No, but it is. But yeah, of course, it's like, it's super fun. And it's literally my childhood fantasy. Like, there's no, and I don't think I'll ever get sick of the theater of it. Like, I love restaurants and I love going to a new restaurant and I love just the whole like pageantry of it. I love sitting down and being handed a menu. I love looking at the menu online beforehand. I love like someone just bringing me like incredible things to try, even if they're not, if they don't end up being good or interesting, just like the sort of anticipation of it all. And like, yeah, it's a totally thrilling, wonderful thing.
Do you think you can /want/will do this forever?
I don't know. I mean, I could see a world in which I do it forever. And if you look around, like, people who do this tend to do it for a really long time. And I think there's something really kind of amazing about that. And like, and I do feel like I've noticed, you know, that the longer I do it, the more of a relationship people feel like they have with me, which I like. Maybe that's like a totally egotistical thing to say, but I feel like just very like it feels very validating to realize that someone could have been reading me for the whole time I've been doing it and feels like it's something that they look forward to. Like, I feel like people feel like we're in conversation in a way that is meaningful to me, because I think that's how I like to be a reader. And so to feel like I'm creating that experience for readers is really a cool thing. But I also kind of can't imagine eating like this for the rest of my life, or even for, you know, many more years. It just like, it doesn't really feel sustainable. Clearly it is for some people, but it's just like, it is such an excessive thing. Like, I'm not a person who can control myself particularly. So it's like, if I go out to eat, like, I'm eating everything. I think there are people who will have one bite of something or who just are very just careful about what they're eating and how they're eating. And I just, like, I totally just let myself go into the experience. And that seems, like, dangerous. And, like, so far it's been fine, but I don't know, just I feel like aging and eating, it's like you have to at some point kind of rein it in, right? I don't know.
So it won't be the, like, schedule stress, and it won't be the, like, lack of casual eating. It's just, like, it might be too much food.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah, it's a lot of food. It's, like, yeah, just, like, and restaurant food is very different than food that anybody makes at home. You know, it's like I don't think the body is meant to eat like that. Yeah. Every single day. It's like a high impact sport.
Yeah.
in some ways.
Yeah, it sounds to me like what you're saying is, like, like you'd like to play forever.
Yeah. But I'm like Tom Brady.
Yeah, but Tom Brady at some point, like, started, like, you know, only eating, like,
strawberries.
A quarter of an avocado a
yeah.
day.
Or does he not eat strawberries? He either eats strawberries or doesn't eat strawberries.
He might eat,
like
one strawberry, cut up
right.
over several right. hours.
Right.
You're going to have to get into, like, pliability.
Exactly. Yeah. But on the other hand, I remember when I got the job, a friend said to me, "Oh, so you're just done. Like, this is what you're going to do for the rest of your life." And I hadn't really occurred to me. I was like, yeah, maybe. And so maybe. I could totally see myself looking up in 20 years and being like, wow, I'm still the restaurant. I mean, a lot of things have to fall into place for that to be true. Like, the magazine industry has to keep afloat. So knock on wood. But it is hard to imagine giving up something that has so many obvious advantages.
I mean, imagine how disappointed 10-year-old Hannah would be.
Yeah, that's the thing. And what would I do? What would I do after? It's like, if you achieve your ultimate childhood dream, what do you do after that? I don't want to know. Seems scary.
Sounds to me like you got to start doing pliability stuff.
Okay.
Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Seth Kelly edited this episode. Megan Valley handled the show notes. Thanks to both of them. Thanks to Vox, with whom we make this show. And thanks to Hannah Goldfield. Her New Yorker column is called Tables for Two. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.